This is HPR episode 1873 entitled, TIT Radio 21, I Thought I Had Better Links, and is part of the series, TIT Radio. It is hosted by 5150, and is about 70 minutes long. The summary is, TIT Radio rides again.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Yeah, the best way to get around that is use marshmallows, or get some like pantyhose and start tying off like little bundles of peanut butter. Like put some peanut butter in some cloth and like take some string and tie it around the actual like a trigger plate there, so that they have to actually try to get into it. And when they do, it'll depress the plate and kill them.
I've switched to those plastic mouse traps from the old standard wooden ones with the wire. They got a little cup in them, and they almost have to, I mean, they really have to get in there to get it, so they've been working real well. Jesus Christ, you think somebody that does podcasts would have a good internet connection? Oop, we're recording.
So are we doing KPO or TIT Radio tonight?
Well, since Peter's not going to be here, I think it's a TIT. We're having a TIT.
And what is our policy on cursing?
It's a free-for-all.
Yeah,
all right.
That's not going to work. As soon as I started recording, the connection dropped long enough to kick me out. So if someone besides Kay Wisher wants to record just in case, I'll do the editing. One of you guys can send it to me.
I'm not sure I can make it past 11:30.
I'm recording.
Okay, well, let's get started. Folks, we're continuing the TIT Radio tradition this evening on Hacker Public Radio. This will be episode 121. I'm your host this evening, 5150, and also on the channel we have... You guys not hearing me again?
You dropped off when you started the introduction.
I heard him.
Well, in any case, we also have Kay Wisher.
Evening.
We've got Netminer.
Evening. Thank you, folks.
And we have TJ.
Hey.
Now, I didn't hear you, TJ.
Hopefully everyone else did.
Can we all hear each other?
I heard TJ with a little creak.
I've heard everyone but 5150 at times.
Okay. Like I said, if somebody drops off mid-sentence, those are in the IRC, you can drop something in there. Folks listening, I think I've been having some ISP problems, so and I think it's actually dropping off more often than I know, but it's apparently it's just almost immediately. Dropping off and coming back, and I think it takes Mumble down when it does that. So let's hope we can finish the podcast with a minimum of technical difficulties. And if you've been listening to HPR, a few weeks ago we posted TIT Radio 120, so I think everybody who listens should be familiar with what we're doing here. It's sort of a news discussion, general BSing group that used to air on, well, I guess I shouldn't say used to because we're back again, that airs on Hacker Public Radio on the weekends that almost said KPO, not KPO, Linux Hacks was Linux Cranks. Linux Hacks would be a good podcast though. Linux Cranks was recorded. So we got Since KPO hasn't been on in a few weeks with people not being around, I've already been scolded for the sheer number of links that I pasted into the Google Docs. So does anybody have one that they'd like to start talking about? Okay, how about we start with 1,000 self-targeting sniper rifles can be remotely hacked. Good evening, Taj.
Hey, what's good, everybody?
Howdy.
Hey, man, what's going on?
Tonight I has a mumble.
Is there any easy way to click on a link in the Google Doc and open a page? I remember we do this on Linux Slugcast, I have to physically paste the link.
Right-click, and one of the options is open link.
Okay, I see it. And there goes my mouse again down the hallway. I think this is interesting. We were so proud a year ago when we had these self-targeting sniper rifles for the military that were powered by Linux. In other words, rather than the shooter guessing windage and elevation and all that, that the scope was supposed to do it for him. Unfortunately, it looks like to get it working, they pretty much turned off any and all security features in Linux. So they have Wi-Fi, so you could remotely log into these guns with no credentials at all. Now, the good part is you can't actually make them fire remotely. That still requires a trigger pull, but you can definitely get in there and change the parameters so that the sights aren't accurate.
So have they actually determined what part is the flaw, the Linux part or the Android part?
I'm trying to scroll down and my browser won't still lock up. I've got among my other problems, I've got darn many tabs open. But I guess this came out of Black Hat. I guess these must be some really dedicated hackers. It's Runa Sandvik and her husband Michael Auger, and they said they tested on two of the $13,000 self-aiming rifles. So I'm assuming, you know, they bought these themselves, but they figured out how to brick the rifle, how to make targeting unstable, and getting root access to the targeting system. I guess the company really doesn't care because they're no longer shipping any rifles. Probably nobody wanted to pay $13,000 for a rifle. But no, Kay Wisher, to answer your question, the article doesn't say very much on exactly how they exploited the rifle itself.
Actually, I know the Barretts have a similar capability, so there are some very expensive stuff that works that way.
I have always wanted to fire one of those. Like, I don't know if I'd want to do it much, but just one time.
Well, they have this guy, you know, at the top of the page, firing as fast as he can pull the trigger. I don't think at that point the sights are doing him much good.
I know that there's a 15-year-old girl who fires a Barrett.
Look, I have no problem admitting that I'm probably weaker than a 15-year-old girl when it comes to gun recoil hitting me.
Actually, I saw Kelly Pickler wrapped around one of them. It was amazing that the gun was about her size. She was doing a tour out in the sandbox somewhere.
Another one I thought that would be interesting to some of the friends of the show is Dot, the smartwatch, Braille smartwatch for the visually impaired.
But can I link it up to my smart sniper rifle?
Well, if you did, though, can you beat the hackers?
So does it work like a scope? Like you just put the Braille watch up to your eye and the little dots tell you where to aim? Like just pokes you in the eye and leads you around? That'd be kind of awesome, not gonna lie.
Hey, I met a blind guy in astronomy class. Strange things happen.
I guess I have to learn to read Braille now.
I tried doing that just as an experiment, and Jesus, is that hard.
I remember somebody over at MIT who had a Braille printer. It used a modified teletype, no lie, and a ton of probably flip chips.
Okay, well, on the article and in the picture you see, this smartwatch has four sets of six-dot Well, this is dots. They're sort of pins that slide up and down, which raise and lower at speeds of up to 100 per second to produce four Braille characters at the time. So if you've ever seen Sneakers and you had the one member of the team who was blind, he had this that he could hook up to the computer and put his fingers on. And those were an actual thing. That was his interface to the computer. So this is kind of a smaller version of that, no display at all.
I mean, it's kind of a cool idea that I think culturally we have this need for some new way to transmit information that is not looking at a screen, because I think that's where the whole wearable thing comes from. People are complaining, I don't want to take it out of my pocket. Wouldn't it be cool if, like, we all understood some kind of, like, haptic system like Braille, to where, you know, all your notifications just, like, you felt them. You didn't have to look at anything. I think that would be a cool idea. I'm not sure anybody would learn it unless it was pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah, but I'm wondering how far away we are from something. Oh, well, probably a little less geeky or obvious to the outside observer, Google Glass. I'm thinking at some time we're going to have at least like a contact with all that to display that sort of information for us.
Yeah, but there have been studies that show that like visual input is not the best way to take in information like that, and that actually could be, frankly, kind of dangerous. So I'm sure that there will be some kind of research into something else. It's one of those things that I've thought about. Like, what other ways can we transfer that information that was less intrusive?
I still want the smartwatch tattoo.
I would think it'd be easier to make a watch that just push a button and it audibly gave the time, and a lot cheaper.
But a whole lot more annoying.
Well, the article mentions that, you know, why not use Siri or something equivalent, and they're saying that the visually impaired individuals find that more impersonal than this. I mean, and really, at $300 is what it, you know, this doesn't seem like such a bad deal. It's not that expensive.
Compared to other accessibility things, that's not expensive at all. That's remarkably cheap.
And I didn't. There's a couple things I thought we might go about that we talked. Well, we kind of talked it to death last night on Linux Slugcast after reading a link that Kay Wisher posted, and I'll add to the show notes. It seems as if things may not be quite as bad as how they look. What we're talking about. The FCC has gone to device manufacturers with some new rules and say, you know, we need you to show us that there's no way to modify your software, use software to modify the operating parameters of your Wi-Fi radios, because I guess some of the cheaper routers have gone to software on the chip, where I guess the radio and the CPU are actually the same chip, so it'd be very hard to isolate the one from the other. And the other thing is they've gone to or are working towards going to software-defined radio for everything, because it's cheaper to build one generic radio chip than it is to build separate ones for Wi-Fi and different ones for other uses. If you listen to Tilts this past Wednesday, they had a guest from Save Wi-Fi, and I'll also put that link in the show notes. He's Chris Wade, who's the CEO of Think Penguin, who makes computers with Linux pre-installed. And they're afraid it looks like not only may affect whether we can have open source software on routers, but that they might effectively ban open source software on any computing device. Now, I'll find the link, but it's a pretty credible source said no. There's some statements from the FCC that the FCC is saying no. All we wanted was assurances that these devices could not be used to maliciously or otherwise interfere with Doppler radar at runways. We know at no time intended for the manufacturers of these devices to solve the problem by banning people from installing whatever software they wanted on their device. Do you guys get all? I know I tend to break up when I go into soliloquy mode.
Yeah, it seemed to make sense. Also, I know that on the receiving side, certain European SDR TV dongles can be pushed way outside the television bands for all kinds of radio reception, including aircraft beacons of various kinds.
That's well, Rob, fun.
That was the first thing that came out a couple years ago, was the European TV.
Reminds me, maybe I should buy one before they lock them up.
He's got one or is planning to get one to experiment, but he's got a ham license. But the thing is, they can be sold to anybody, whether you have a license or not, whether you have malicious or intent or not, or whether you know what you're doing or not. I've been thinking for a while that, man, the FCC is going to bring the ban hammer down on that. But at least a good thing, I think the FCC is smart enough to know there are people out here using open source. And maybe on the cheap routers, they would let them get away, that it would be very hard to isolate the radio from the rest of the components as far as code-wise, that might be an unintended consequence, but it might be acceptable to them for the manufacturer coming out. Well, the only way we lock down this router is to have signed firmware, that only our firmware can go on. But they've already said it was not their intention to ban things like OpenWRT and DDWRT, as long as OpenWRT and DDWRT don't include tools that would see for the 5 gigahertz, they've had to open up enough bandwidth. Those routers can actually operate in the same frequencies as the Doppler radar. And the only problem is your house is right there on the runway. You would interfere, and there's software in there to say, okay, if you can hear one of these airport radars, you can't use those bands. And there's a statement from the FCC that I saw, or supposedly from the FCC, says that as long as, you know, OpenWRT and whatever you put on the router, it abides by that. It doesn't let you override it and interfere with those radars. You say we're cool with open source software. And I really think and the onus on this is on the device manufacturer. So they're not quite going to go to if somebody had a Windows computer, they would have to Microsoft would have to put a certification on every piece of software that's installed. Probably set it up. The only way you put software on Windows is through the Microsoft Store. Now, that may be something that they want to do anyway. I'm not sure that they're that point yet where they decided to do it. So you'd have, since the onus is on the manufacturer, if the manufacturer said set it up so you can only install Windows, then you'd have to get cooperation of Microsoft so that Microsoft would only install certified software.
Just to kind of clarify for Netminer, I don't think the FCC will ever come after those TV dongles because they're only receive. You can't transmit on them. It just doesn't have the stuff in it to do it. So it's basically a glorified antenna and just a way to process the signals that are coming over it. So I don't think they'll ever come for that because there's no risk of that being dangerous to any frequencies.
I just wanted to put, by the time this show gets out, probably everybody will have heard of that, but I'll put in a link anyway, and the main thrust of this is there is a period of open comment to the FCC that by the time this show comes out, you should be able to get to the site and comment. That'll be opened October 9, and just there, if you hear my voice, if you care about being able to run whatever software you want on your computing devices, you need to participate in that not survey, but comment period. Say, do a few paragraphs on why you need to run open source, why you think it's more secure, why it's your device, and you ought to be able to decide what to run on it. And so we don't come up with a time where that software companies and the hardware companies get together and say, yeah, rather than doing anything to change our hardware, isolating the radio part of it or whatever, we've just decided to lock down the software and lock everybody else out. From the statement I saw from somebody supposedly from FCC, that doesn't, they were categorically denying that their idea of a solution was to ban open source. But if they don't think anybody cares, who knows? So we need to get out there and make sure that they know we have a voice.
Sounds like they're going to require some kind of radio BIOS so that depending on your region, you you say I'm in the USA, and that gives you a certain locale with certain channels, power levels, etc.
Well, it's and that is one of the things that it did with EWRT. It may have to, and OpenWRT may have to change, is that Europe allows the Wi-Fi, at least the 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, and everything says they really don't have 2.4 gigahertz, to broadcast a slightly higher power than what's allowed in America, because America has this as a lower standard for power output than most of the rest of the world. And rather than, you know, making one version of the router for America and one version for everybody else, you know, they're not going to do that. They make just one version, and then their firmware controls, you know, keeps it from going as high as it could, as the hardware would let it do. So that's probably one thing they may have to consider quit doing. But no, that minor, I really don't think you're going to see different versions for different countries, because that it's my understanding pretty much whatever the FCC decides, Canada follows suit, all of Europe follows suit, most of the rest of the world enacts the same exact same regulations.
Well, I know that Wi-Fi in Japan has some more channels.
Okay, do we care that Google's now Alphabet?
Depends on what Alphabet does with the Google world, including like YouTube.
Well, I think it may make them easier to get rid of parts that they think aren't making money. You know, it might be easier to get rid of G Plus now, but I really don't think it's going anywhere.
Honestly, at this point, I wouldn't be too upset if it did go away.
The only thing that G Plus does for me is give me some way of commenting on YouTube, and YouTube had a comment system before G Plus was hammered onto it.
Right, and then they're supposed to be separating them again.
Yeah, but if G Plus shuts down, what's the alternative? I mean, like Facebook? I mean, a lot of people who don't want to use that, there's not much other choice. Not that Google Plus is much better than Facebook, but it's another case where I wish there was something more open and federated.
Well, there is, we just don't use it.
Google Groups or Usenet.
Well, I was actually thinking of Diaspora.
Yeah, but that's the problem. I've never used Diaspora, and I don't know anybody who does. It's that kind of, there's the hurdle to the whole thing. Like, everybody as a community would have to jump ship and go to something new, and nobody has used anything to try it yet, I guess, is the problem.
Well, I wonder if it has anything to do with getting away from the government deciding Google's a monopoly.
Probably in Europe. I think they'd have more of a go of it there than they would here.
It may allow Google wherever to comply with regulations in various countries, including like Communist China, by having separate Googles for every legal domain. A Google working within the Great Firewall is going to be a very different Google from the one that you and I use, I hope.
And expectedly, the first Windows 10 patch caused infinite reboots in a lot of their systems. So reading it was caused by something about, well, or it's fixed by removing security information from the registry for users that had been deleted. So I can't imagine that might be a problem on big corporate installations, but not probably for the average home user.
The interesting thing that I found was that they're adding the same kind of bugging patches to Windows 7 and Windows 8.
Well, of course, that way the users don't have any incentive anymore not to update. If Windows 7 becomes just as much a NSA-inspired software as 10, you might as well get the free update.
See, I knew when they were like, oh, you can upgrade to Windows 10 for free, I knew there was going to be some kind of hook, and that's the one. We get to track everything you do.
From what I've been hearing lately is that they are backporting all that tracking stuff into Windows 7 and 8. That's what's bothering me.
Well, I know some ways around it. VPNs, and have your Windows just run VirtualBox machines talking to something else as your portal to the internet.
There has to be some kind of kill switch for, like, all that phone home stuff somewhere in there. Because I can't imagine, like, a massive business with, you know, thousands of users using Windows. I mean, even if it's a small amount of bandwidth, that's a sizable amount of bandwidth going over your network.
Well, I mean, it depends on whose article you read. So I've seen articles say, oh, it's not that bad. You can go here and here and here and over there and that place and this place and individually turn the stuff off. And then other articles say, no, you get some of it, but you can't get all of it.
Well, for one thing, there's regulatory stuff that they're tromping all over.
I know in a recent Security Now podcast, Steve Gibson, they covered some of that, and he said he would absolutely not move to Windows 10 because of all the security issues and the founding home issues.
Looks like at least another 10 years of XP, then.
No, the smart ones will turn Windows into a shell and run VMs through it in spite of it.
But why, when there's Linux? I just can't fathom. I mean, I understand, you know, it's the most popular operating system, but if you don't like it, you know, like I do, and I refuse to use it unless I have to, I just can't understand why somebody would keep using it with all these backdoors and finding home, collecting data collection type stuff.
Well, simple. Use it as a driver's platform. That's why I'm using it. I have a number of screens running on Display Link that Linux just doesn't support yet.
You missed the last part of our show last night, Netminer. They've got Display Link working now over USB 3.0.
Yeah, I have USB 2 that I bought specifically for Linux compatibility, but it's still a hairy thing to try to run multiple exes. And multi-seat seems to have gone the way of Fedora 17.
And we've also had the... sorry, I stepped out for a minute. We also had the Yeah, I really stepped out there. We've also had the problem of Windows 10. You can't disable automatic updates. Now, that might not be a horrible idea for a home user, but it's your computer. You ought to be able to decide when you update. But, I mean, it's got to be disastrous for a lot of these corporations where they, you know, they test updates before they allow them to go to the clients.
That forbidden update switch is only on the home versions. If you buy the corporate version, you have control of that switch.
Okay, I'd seen a YouTube video for somebody that was at work was on Pro, and they couldn't disable it there either.
Well, at least that's what they were selling it as. They might have changed their mind in midstream, like the sneaky devils they are.
And of course, when they're
I was going to say, it's just another way for them to sneakily just, like, destroy your Grub setup every time that updates.
And, of course, I think the first security thing came out was that, you know, that if it hands, if your machine knows a wireless password, it passes it along to every other machine on the network that you hook up to. So, I mean, if you're going from one place to another on a work network where the clients can talk to each other, then everybody on that work network is going to know your home wireless password.
I don't think that's the way that works. I mean, you have to, from what I heard from Security Now, there's something you have to enable, and then there's you have to the like, say you have a user comes into your home and wants to get on your Wi-Fi. The person who controls the Wi-Fi has to give them permission. It'll pass the key to somebody that they allow. It just doesn't pass it along to anybody.
Yeah, but the way I'd understood it.
Welcome back, 50. Please restart your statement.
Oh, you guys didn't get that? I didn't realize it was gone. I'm just saying if if the Wi-Fi password sharing was as bad as originally reported, surely by now somebody at Microsoft has recognized what a colossally bad idea that was and changed it so it's only opt-in.
Well, you know that that home groups enable sharing about everything on your system, and that's a Windows 7 feature.
Because networking is just too hard for the average Windows user.
Right, and giving people decent controls would be too hard for the average Microsoftie.
Well, I found this one interesting. It's Krebs on Security, that Ubiquiti suffered a $46 million cyber heist. How big is Ubiquiti if they're not just out of business now? I guess what they did, they actually, all they did was send email. I'm amazed companies do business this way in the 21st century. But, essentially they spoofed emails from company executives to somebody in the financial part of the company and says, transfer $20 million to this Swiss bank account. And I don't know if it's a Swiss bank account, but a bank account somewhere. Then, of course, the criminals grabbed the money from and took off. And, of course, you know, it's easy enough to make it seem. I mean, you don't have to actually get a hold of the email server. You can make the to string whatever you want, and unless you're looking deeper into the email, the average person wouldn't know. And I mean, they're not doing anything terribly sophisticated. They're just sending an email from Yahoo or wherever and changing the from string to be somebody inside the company, and that's all it takes. Am I still on, or are you guys just not an interesting subject?
No, it's interesting. We're just listening. Also, I've thought about trying to teach, some of my medical professionals about secure email, but don't think it would get very far.
I guess one way they do it, they register a domain that is, one letter different from the company's real domain name, or might look like a subsidiary or something. And, you throw in TJ at crapple.com or something like that. And they get their, if TJ was the president, then take all their money.
Microsoft.
So, I mean, I guess it's usually done with, they just wire money to an account in China. Man, we should all be crooks if it's that easy.
So that's what Peter's doing.
Well, if he comes back driving a Rolls, you'll know where he got the money.
I guess Ubiquiti has said they've already recovered $8.1 million, and another $7 million they think they can get back. In other words, the criminals didn't withdraw the money from the Chinese account fast enough, so they got out there and said, no, this is an illegal transfer, we want our money back. But that's still, $30 million that they lost outright, looks like. And the drawback is, I mean, you can't just say, show up at the bank and withdraw your $40 million.
Yes, but would you trust people with this idea of security with security devices on your system?
No, but that's isn't that the definition of CEO? So you got to hire somebody who doesn't know a thing about security.
Also, aren't there the people who do the edge router that people were thinking about putting things like pfSense on or whatnot?
Yep, you're right, Netminer.
Maybe the pfSense people should make them an offer, and they'd have their own hardware company just by the edge portion of the throat. They couldn't do any worse than the company that's running it now.
Well, like I said, this is a social engineering hack. It had nothing to do with their electronic security. I mean, this is easy to defeat as making a phone call and says, Mr. Johnson, did you really just tell me to send $45 million to China?
Yeah, well, that's what you get of making the average worker scared of his boss enough that he won't bother him even when he should.
And, of course, once again, Lenovo's been caught with their fingers in the security pie. Essentially put a rootkit on their machine, so even if you wiped it and installed your own copy of Windows, that all the Lenovo crapware would come back on its own.
Damn, I've been thinking about getting an old Lenovo, but I don't know whether I could trust it.
Well, I've got a T60 sitting here right now. I think that's probably old enough.
Yeah, I was thinking T60s, T61, running Linux as my portable.
Apparently, the software, quote, sends system data to a Lenovo server to help us understand how our customers use our products. In other words, it's spyware. What it's doing, the BIOS on the machine checks for C:\Windows/System32/AutoCheck.exe to see if it's the original Microsoft version or a Lenovo signed one, and if it's the Microsoft one, it overwrites it with Lenovo's version, and AutoCheck is executed on boot. And then it downloads Lenovo update.exe and Lenovo check.exe, which set up a service and download other spyware files. And apparently, there is a security bulletin. I guess it doesn't give many details, but it says that hackers have found a way to use Lenovo Service Engine to install their own malicious software. Thanks, Kay Wisher, for coming on. We'll see you later. There is a patch available, but you have to know about it and download it yourself. The patch removes all of this from your BIOS and gets rid of it.
You know, funny thing, Microsoft, who's bugging the system anyway, could look at Lenovo's and remind you need to patch your BIOS.
Well, actually, Lenovo is using a technique sanctioned by Microsoft. I mean, it was Microsoft's idea in the first place. Windows Platform Binary Table came out in 2011. In other words, Microsoft provided Lenovo with the tools to do this.
How many other people have they handed the same toolkit to?
Well, if malware got a hold of this, you know, you'd never be able to clean the infection from your machine. And the article will be in the show notes. I'm not going to go through the show notes and delete what we didn't talk about. So just like last time, dear listener, you may find other interesting information in the show notes. Let's see. It looks like partial list, at least, is the Flex 2 Pro 15, the Edge 15, Flex 3 1470, 1570, and 1120, G40 to G80, G50 to G40-80, G50-80, G50-80 Touch, V3000, S21E, S4170/U4070, S345/M4035, Yoga 314, Yoga 311, Y4080, Z41-70/750-70, and Z70-80/G70-80. So I don't know how big a part of Lenovo's lineup that is, but probably just like last time, it's the consumer models, not the pro models. I think I may just get a copy of that Lenovo tool when I'm cleaning a system up, run it by default, because eventually, you know, the malware guys will get a hold of this, and if they're smart enough to hack a BIOS.
Well, gentlemen, what's the next topic?
Oh, that's the thing. I need to put the topic or put the link back into the Mumble notes for those who have joined late. But I've been picking all the topics, guys. You can see them. Pick one that looks good.
I've got one to talk about. Let's talk about the article about the GameKid Kickstarter, because nobody should back this at all.
Okay, that's the one that's the Game Boy clone?
Yes, and the reason I say nobody should back this thing is because there is basically the exact same thing as an Adafruit article, and you can download and print all the pieces and put it together yourself, and that's better. Just do that.
How would the price of sourcing your own components compared to what they're asking for in the crowdfunding?
To be honest, I'm not sure. It would be a lot less for me because I have a 3D printer, and I probably have all that the case materials just laying around. I could do that myself. I'm not even sure how much Kickstarter is asking for. Let me look.
Well, I was going to say, that would probably be the deciding factor, whether you had access to a 3D printer.
Yeah, but there are things, there are different ways to get access to a 3D printer if you don't have one. So, like, you could go to 3D Hubs or something like that, and just somebody locally, or even not locally, you could, you know, pay somebody to print it for you. There's lots of resources out there for people. Like, I know I keep hearing that as an excuse for why people don't want to make things. They're like, oh, well, it takes a 3D printer, and but there are ways to use a 3D printer even if you don't have one.
Well, I think also, I think the fact that they're willing to package everything for you is what's going to hook the man on the street.
I also don't see this actually making it to production without Nintendo suing the ever-loving bejesus out of them.
Well, I assume you probably have to, you probably still have to go out and download the ROMs yourself. Surely they're not stupid enough to sell product with the ROMs pre-installed.
No, I'm not even talking about that. I mean, just even the design of the unit, just the case. I mean, it's obvious that that's where it came from. I'm pretty sure if they wanted to push the issue, they could probably make a case out of it.
Well, I think you're right about that. Of course, it's a whole lot more chunky than an actual Game Boy. I mean, look at this thing. I wouldn't want to hold it up in my hands for more than about 10 minutes at a time.
So it looks like it's about $140 to get everything that you want. And I would say that's probably pretty similar to just buying the kit and putting it together. And the nice thing about the kit is if you know how to change the case files and you know a little electronics, you can do whatever you want. You can add new buttons and do lots of stuff to it. So I don't know. It just seems more flexible to me to build one, but I have the skills. So maybe if you weren't into that, but there's tons of like ROM emulator little handheld things now. I just can't see spending $140 on it if there wasn't something more to it.
Yeah, Raspberry Pi based, whatever.
Well, this is Raspberry Pi based. It's just that they're doing everything for you.
I mean, if I was going to go the way of a dedicated like ROM emulator machine, I would definitely probably go with like the Open Pandora or the new version of that. I forget what it's called. Like, because then I have a whole Linux computer in my hand that I can use instead of just a little Game Boy thing.
Well, right. I mean, it's kind of rather a waste of a Pi. I mean, I don't know, unless you're going to take this on the train with you. Well, you don't get your wish, Tosh, because they've blown past their goal by $6,000.
Oh, I knew they would. I just wished it didn't happen. I don't know. It's just, and part of me is like, this was somebody else's idea. Like, Adafruit came up with this idea like a year ago and put out the plans and everything. And it's just kind of like, these people looked at it and were like, oh, we're going to do our own version of that and then try to make money off of it. Which I guess is technically okay. I don't know how Adafruit licensed their stuff. But I mean, it's just, I don't know. Just didn't want to see them get too rewarded for ripping somebody off. Although, to be fair, both parties are just blatantly ripping off Game Boy, so I guess I don't have, like, a good ethical ground to stand on to begin with.
Yeah, I'm looking on the crowdfunding page. If they ever acknowledge, hey, this really isn't our idea, we're just implementing it for you so you don't have to do it.
I will admit, there's one design choice that I like about this version of it, is that they put the two buttons on the back, where on the Adafruit one, because of the TFT panel, it had four little buttons underneath the screen. So if you wanted to do, if you were like emulating Super Nintendo or something where it had the, I guess the trigger buttons or whatever, the little bumper buttons on the edge, you'd have to reach up to the screen to hit them. At least if they were on the back, that would be a little easier. But that would be something that you could very easily mod and do with the other one.
Well, that's one thing that I'm going to do with my RPI 2. I was looking at things like, there's Noobs, and then there's the other one. I'll think of it. That's what I had on my RP, where you could boot into multiple OSs on the same SD card. But I found one the other day that I think I'm going to use. That you boot it, you boot into a regular Linux. I think it may be Raspbian or whatever, but you can seamlessly move into Kodi or one of the game emulators and go back out. And so you have all the same functionality without having to reboot the box. And I'm going to hook that up to the TV, and I've already got a USB controller that I bought a while back. It's a lot more comfortable to hold than to, hold this old brick in your hand and squint at the, 2-inch screen?
Yeah, we have one of the original Model A Or it was the first Raspberry Pi. I don't know if that was Model A or Model A came later. I can never keep track. I set it up for my wife with RetroPie. And so basically we just, because she loves old games, so she'll sit there and play on the RetroPie. But then I have like a little SD card holder that I printed that has like 4 or 5 SD cards, and we'll just swap them out. So like if we want to use Kodi, we just throw in the Kodi card and reboot it. And I made a little case for it to where we could get to the SD card slot real easy. So, I mean, it's worked out. It would be nice to be able to do it just, you know, without rebooting. But to be honest, it takes like 2 seconds to reboot anyways. It's not that big of a deal for me.
Just saying, when I got dropped, Berry Boot is the other multiple operating systems on a single SD card system. I guess it's not really an operating system, but a launcher, I guess you might call it. It's comparable to Noobs. The main difference, I think, I still have my SD card, so I haven't overwritten them. So someday for HPR, I'm going to try to write a comprehensive comparison between Noobs and Berry Boot.
That would be cool. I kind of fell off the Raspberry Pi wagon. I got on early and then just sort of dropped out. So I'm behind. I know that you guys were talking about it last night, that the what's the podcast, the Linux Luddites, that they have, one of the guys that started like a Raspberry Pi podcast, so I might check that out too.
Oh, I bookmarked that, but I didn't realize that was who was doing it. Cool.
I believe it is. I could be completely wrong, but I've heard a couple people talk about it. Like, I think Dora was talking about it on Links for the Rest of Us, and then last night, I've heard a couple people mention it, and I think it's related to that podcast. Of course, I could be completely wrong.
Well, gentlemen, I think I'm going to retire, if that's all right with you. Thank you for everything tonight, and I'll catch you in a couple weeks, perhaps with our wandering Aussie back home.
Later, man. Have a good one.
Can anybody hear me? Because I'm not hearing anybody.
Yeah, we're still here. Well, I am. Netminer just took off.
Yeah, maybe getting a little late for him. Still with us, TJ?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, how about we pick another topic?
What about Stephen Hawking's sweet new open source gear?
Oh, yeah, that is a good one, because he's put it all out, like you said, open source.
If this is complete as I think it is, then this will be a huge boon to like the open source accessibility people, because if all the components are there, and I haven't looked at it because frankly I haven't had the time to, it could solve a lot of problems that are stumbling blocks just that we just don't have access to.
Well, I saw the movie and it looks like he's doing everything with maybe a couple fingers on one hand and a thumb on the other.
I may be making this up, but I thought at this point he only had control of his head, and so he was doing it all with a head paddle, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, like I said, I think the movie stopped with publishing his last big, or his big book or whatever, so yeah, it's possible. Because I never knew he even had that much control over the rest of his body, so you may be right.
I also love the fact that he gets all this like really nice decked out new software and he still uses the old voice, because that has become Stephen Hawking's voice. Like, that's what's recognizable. So it's still the just like old terrible voice reproduction that it was, but it's all this new back end that makes it go faster, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah, I guess they adapted SwiftKey, so you know, that does prediction, so he has to type 20% fewer characters, and by type, like I said, I don't know if that means he's using his hands at all, or like you said, if he's using one of those targeting systems that knows what he's looking at.
And that's one of the parts of it that I hope is actually open source. I have a sneaking suspicion that that's probably not part of it, since it came from a proprietary company. If it is, good on them, because that is something that, at least in my experience, open source has lacked as a good prediction for that sort of thing.
Well, it says, quote from the article, different functions could be enabled by touch, eye blinks, eyebrow movements, or other user input. So it doesn't talk anything about one of those sight targeting systems.
But I'm just like big picture looking at this and thinking, man, if they could integrate part of this into Sonar, that would, especially because Sonar already has eye tracking, that would be amazing, to where you could literally get a commodity off the shelf tablet of some sort that was x86 based, like some of the older tablets, or even the computer that you just hacked together to be a touchscreen, and put that on a wheelchair, and you're replacing a piece of equipment that costs, you know, $15,000 to $20,000. I mean, you could do it for a couple hundred dollars. That's amazing.
Right. Well, when they show in the movie that first hacked together system they had, and that was what was supposed to be the early 80s, so it was amazing they could have done it back then.
Yeah, once again, we're dealing with companies who can make equipment and then jack it up to all sorts of outrageous prices because they know there are subsidies that will pay for it. So that's one of the reasons why, in my experience, trying to push any open alternative has been a ridiculously hard battle.
And he probably what he'd been using to until now was something of very similar to what he started out with. The quote is, "My system was over 20 years old, and I was finding it difficult to communicate effectively." He says the new system is life changing, and hope will serve me for the next 20 years. And the nice thing about that is, probably it was 20 years old because the company that made the technology wasn't around anymore and wasn't updating anything. And now with this system, they can, update it constantly and add more functions.
Yeah, but at the same time, I can imagine, especially if this was your mode of communication, that you would want it to stay as similar as possible. Because I'm thinking about there are musicians who use like computers from the early 90s because that's like their favorite instrument, and it's what they're used to. They don't want to learn anything new because it works. And I could imagine if that was the way you communicated, you would want the increased performance, but you wouldn't want it to change as far as interface, at least not a lot, because that would be a huge learning curve, I would think.
And we should give it credit to Intel. I guess it was developed by Intel, and they've open sourced it.
Probably the only time I will thank Intel publicly is right now.
And it's called ACAT, Assistive Context Aware. In the same article, there's some interesting things that I'd like to pursue later. There's a Japanese town where they've done street view at the level of a cat.
That sounds remarkably Japanese of them.
And I already opened the one on the Millennium Falcon quadricopter because I looked at the one that they are going to be selling in Walmart, and it's like $90.
Yet another hobby I would love to get into, but don't have time, quads. So just as a follow-up to what we were just talking about a minute ago, this ACAT, I found the GitHub for it. It is PC only, and that is stupid, so I retract my thank you to Intel until they give me a Linux port.
Oh, it's open source, but it only runs on Windows.
It'll run on Windows 10, though. So what the hell's the point of making it open source?
Oh, Intel, you lull me. This is my favorite part. ACAT doesn't include Professor Stephen Hawking's voice. It supports Microsoft's speech API, and I'm sure that that is not in any way open source.
Oh, and today I saw the a video for the BB-8 toy. That's the new droid that's a hat on top of a round ball rolling around from the the new Star Wars movie. That's that silly looking droid that everybody said, well, that couldn't possibly work from the first few seconds of the video. Well, they've actually got a remote control toy that you can control with your smartphone that does just that.
Yeah, it's just a Sphero with a hat. I've had a Sphero forever. Like, it's fun, it's cool, but they just put a hat on it, and now it's all Star Wars-y. I don't know. I think it's, like most of the things I've seen about the new Star Wars movie, just makes me roll my eyes and want to pretend it's not happening.
Yeah, it is J.J. Abrams. It can't be as bad as the first three episodes. That just wouldn't be possible.
Once again, bringing the audiobook club to this show, it is possible. Did you not see Into Darkness in the horrible travesty of a movie that was?
Well, I don't know. I think I did go. No, I didn't go out and see it, but I rented it. I would say it's probably better than the one. But no, I will never forgive J.J. Abrams for destroying Star Trek. Oh, on that topic, has anybody watched Star Trek Renegades yet?
Yes, I have, and I wish I hadn't.
Okay, that's another one. I thought that was better than at least any J.J. Abrams stuff.
Oh, hell yeah, it was way better than the J.J. Abrams stuff, but it was still atrocious. I don't know. I don't understand how it takes place and where it takes place and things. It just seems like they've kind of gone off the rails and spun it off into kind of its own alternate universe. It's odd. I don't know. Because there are things in it that shouldn't, me being the uber nerd that I am, things don't match up with the timeline the way it should be.
Well, it's certainly not the utopian universe of the original series. I mean, essentially, they're finding an excuse to get on CBS and for reasons they couldn't get it picked up that way.
I don't know. It also suffers from the recent trend of everything has to be related to Khan somehow. Like, we have to get some reference to Khan in everything. And I'm just like, Khan wasn't even that good of a villain. He was in a good movie, but himself was not a good villain.
Now, see, that's where we disagree again. I always liked Khan, at least in the movie. I don't, you know, if I was going to go back to any of the episodes to do, you know, to use it as basis for the movie, I'm not sure Space Seed is the first one that would come to mind. But let's face it, I guess they ripped off the original series for the first two movies.
Well, and I think that's why Khan works in Star Trek 2 is because he has a reason to hate Kirk. Like, specifically, just Kirk. And so it makes it more about those two against each other. And if you take away that motivation, you get into darkness. Like, it's just, I'm angry about my people, which is cool for an episode. The other thing that got me about Renegades was the production quality. Like, they would have a scene with the ships that looked like it was done by, you know, Weta or ILM. I mean, it was gorgeous. And then they would do another scene that was like something on a planet, and it looked like a kindergartner did it. It just didn't match up.
Well, you know, if you go back and compare it to the original sets, though, they've got the technology to do a lot better.
I am excited for Axanar, though. I can't wait for that to come out.
Oh, yeah, we'll see that.
Just a little small thing they did was awesome.
I was worried that the Chinese had rounded up Peter here a couple weeks ago because they arrested 15,000 people for internet crimes. I guess when Peter gets back, we'll have to tell him we won't turn him over to Ubiquity if he gives us a cut of the money. Well, we've been on for about 2 hours, so... Somebody want to pick one last topic?
Sitting here going through and trying to find something real quick.
Yeah, we're not compiled in this evening, so for 6 weeks worth of links, there wasn't much really great in there.
Did you talk about space lettuce yet?
No, I haven't. Let's talk about that.
People ate lettuce in space. It was awesome.
That was more one I was thinking of Peter, but he wasn't here, so he gets to miss out. So I guess on the International Space Station, for the first time, they're actually hydroponically growing their own food, which is, of course, probably the basis for a sci-fi movie where it comes to life and kills them.
That would be fun. No, I mean, it's super cool because you combine this with the fact that they are able to, like, 3D fabricate in space, and we're getting closer and closer and closer to some form of sustainability, which would be nice to have. Now, if they get radiation poisoning from their lettuce, is yet to be seen, which might happen. So, you know, mileage may vary.
Well, you'd have to have something on a long spaceflight mission like to Mars, you know, because every bit of that that's sustainable, and you can eat, you can produce your own. That's payload that you can you don't have to carry. You don't have to carry 2 years of food all the way out and back.
You haven't, by any chance, read the book *The Martian*, have you?
No, that's one I haven't read.
Okay, I don't usually recommend non-Creative Commons things, but that is a book you need to read. It's so good. And they're making a movie out of it, but it's basically proved to me that if I'm ever stranded in space, grow potatoes. Potatoes are the way to go.
Well, unless you get the potato famine.
The space potato famine?
Yeah. You probably want to diversify a little, but, you know, yeah, it's a great vegetable. You get tired of it, probably. Really quick, and I don't know if you'd want to fry French fries in space, but there's a lot of food value there in the potato.
Yeah, deep fat frying in space sounds problematic at best.
And you could take along some chicken, so you'd have eggs. That'll be the next thing I think would be interesting. Do animal husbandry in space.
I think we'd probably have to have a little more than the couple of tin cans we strung together and call a space station for that to be a viable option.
Says here, the astronauts must first clean leafy greens with citric acid-based food sanitizing wipes. Yeah, you wouldn't think there would be nearly as much bacteria there. It would be just out, you know, growing it in a field.
Well, I mean, I think that would be part of the problem with growing it is you don't have the bacteria. And, like, it's hard to keep that going in space because you don't have all the ingredients you have here. So I wonder why they have to, I mean, they're washing it, which is nice, but I wonder why.
And the article also says, which is scary, only half of the vegetables will be eaten and the remainder will be packaged and frozen for return to Earth. So that's what's going to happen. The space lettuce isn't going to kill the astronaut. It's going to come back to Earth and kill us all.
I think in this case, if I was an astronaut on the space station, I might be a meatitarian that week. Just that's all right. You guys can eat the space lettuce. I'm going to sit back here and just watch.
Well, I guess they've already taken it and brought it back to Earth before they let them eat it at all. It was in 2014 they did an experiment in 33 days and returned it to Earth. But I don't know. Space lettuce is tricky. I'm still not cool with this.
I mean, I can imagine, like, and I've heard astronauts say that, like, food is, like, the worst part of being in space because it's, like, all, you know, prepackaged crap. It would probably be a nice change of pace to be able to eat something fresh. So I guess if we can prove it's safe, I'm okay. But I'm sure I would want something more than lettuce. Maybe a couple different kinds of lettuce. Maybe, you know, a vegetable or two to go with that. Maybe some corn. Maybe green beans or something.
Well, you know, have you ever seen one of those World War II submarine movies? And that was one of the things that, you know, all the fresh stuff they ran out of the first week and everything else was canned. And, you know, they come back, they wouldn't want meat because they had meat. That would be preserved. But, you know, they wanted salad and tomatoes and fruit and all that kind of stuff because they hadn't seen it for weeks.
Well, and I mean, just, you know, spitballing, how much of, like, the problems that astronauts have when they come back, we always attribute it to, like, microgravity. What if it's, like, we just don't eat right in space? You know, maybe a salad every once in a while might help them out a little bit.
Right. They do spend a lot of time these days exercising. They don't have room in that thing to have stuff that doesn't, exercise machines that don't rely on gravity that they can use. The illustration at the bottom of it was about like a photo. So we've got some pretty good illustrators working for them. There's a dang mess again. That came in here and joined me.
Yeah, that looks like a pretty substantial garden. If they could pull that off, that would be nice. I'd like to have that garden at my house.
Yeah, I think it'd be a little cheaper to do probably at your house.
Yeah, I'm sure. Definitely. I don't know. Seeds probably don't weigh that much. The dirt would be the most costly thing. But if you're doing, like, hydroponics, you don't even have to carry dirt. You just carry water.
Well, yeah. It's I don't think they have actual dirt. It's like algae or something. It comes in, like, the seeds are implanted into this mat that has what they, you know, what they need. And then the rest is delivered hydroponically. And essentially, you put the mat in the tray and you get it wet and the seeds start growing.
So I think this is an excuse for us to petition to get Tracy Holtz up to the space station with some fish and set him up some aquaponics.
Well, see, that's the problem again. How do you get the water to stay in the tanks? You'd have to seal the tanks.
I don't know. I think that guy could figure out a way.
Oh, yeah, if anybody could.
Then when he comes back, he has space fish, which is even cooler.
They'll either be space fish or weird mishappened monsters.
Either way, I'm remarkably cool with that.
Well, the water would probably be more pure up there. Like I said, I think the radiation would be the factor. I doubt you'd have to worry about mercury.
I bet fish lose it in space with no, like, gravity. Like, I wonder how they react.
Oh, yeah, they wouldn't know where to swim, would they? That'd be cool, the zero-G aquarium. You see fish swim by upside down. Now, Taj, you think those guys are going to get nailed for the Game Boy part. Have you seen the Steam Boy?
Yeah, I saw something about it. But isn't Steam kind of involved in that, like, in some way?
Well, I think the boy part would be the one that gets you in trouble.
Oh, there's no way they're going to call it that. Like, absolutely no way that it's going to be called that.
I'm looking at a picture, and on the LCD it says Steam Boy.
If not from Nintendo, from the anime, like, whoever owns the anime Steam Boy probably would get kind of pissed about it.
I guess it's officially called the Smok Zero. It's got an AMD G series software on chip, not software on chip, but an integrated chip named Step Eagle, Jaguar based CPU, CGN based GPU, And they talked around 1 gigahertz and the GPU 200 to 300 megahertz. So it doesn't seem like there's, wouldn't think that'd be powerful enough to do, but yes, you only have like a 5-inch screen. 4 gig of RAM, 32 gig of storage, expandable with an SD. Yeah, 5-inch 720p touchscreen. Oh, okay, that takes some power to run. HDMI output, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth.
Yeah, I'm sure this is just developed to do the, like, in-home streaming, so you have your, like, actual gaming rig upstairs, and you're just streaming it down, which a Raspberry Pi can handle that. So this is kind of overkill, I think.
Yeah, the gamepad part of it looks a lot like the Steam controller. I don't know, they talk about this like it's an independent unit that you can put in your pocket and take with you. Of course, the battery only lasts 2 hours. They're not talking about it like it's a client unit for a Steam box or a PC.
Then I don't see any way this will work. I really don't. Unless the GPU is a lot heavier than I'm thinking it is, that's going to be a hard sell, because the people you want to sell that to are your hardcore gamers, and they're not going to accept it not being good. So tough to them, I guess. If they could do it, it's cool, but I don't have faith that they can.
Looks like it'll be about $330, which is not as expensive as I would have thought it would have been.
All right, guys. Well, I got to bounce, so I guess I will catch you guys at some later date.
Okay. Well, it's probably a good time to wrap it up. Folks, you've been listening to TIT Radio 121 exclusively for Hacker Public Radio, and with me still on the line, I'm 5150, your host, and you've heard Taj.
That's good, everybody.
And TJ.
I'll see you when I see you.
And we've also... add on the line Kay Wisher, and thanks for recording, of course, Kay Wisher. And I guess I've enjoyed doing these TIT radios, and I hope we can make it an occasional reoccurrence. But that's it for this evening, and we'll catch you folks later. Peace out. Why did I say that? I never say anything about peace out.
It was cool. Just roll with it. So before I run off, 50, did you decide whether you were coming to OLF or not?
I booked a room. I need to really make it sit down this weekend and book a flight to go with it. Though Father Fitch and I may put the rooms together. In other words, he's got depends on when he gets there. I think he only booked for a couple nights, and I booked for 3.
Yeah, I was going to sit down this weekend and try to book a room and stuff, but I'm close enough I can drive, so that's the nice thing. I just got to get a room for the overnight there.
Well, if I can make it, it'll be awesome. If not, I expect a full report.
Well, I'm pretty sure it seems like I'm going, 50's going, Father Finch is going, Kay Wisher's going, I believe. I don't know who else. I've heard a couple other people are going. I'm sure there will be some reporting back from the scene of the crime.
Is Dor going this time? I haven't listened to links for the rest of us for like a month or so.
I think he mentioned it, but I don't know if he actually said if he was going or not. It would be cool if he was going. I found out that he listened to my podcast, and I got a little starstruck. I was like, even though it's Dor, I was just like, oh, wow, somebody who has a successful podcast listening to mine.
Well, he made a point of mentioning that Cody wasn't going, so I kind of got the impression that he'd already planned to. So I haven't heard of any of the Tilts guys say if they're going or not. Well, I have heard Dan said he can't go this year.
I thought Joel said he was going.
He's practically right there.
A little bit.
See, that's why we like you, Pegwall.
Because I treat everyone pretty much the same. It all goes through the I don't really care filter.
When you say you treat everyone the same, you mean shitty, right?
Exactly.
Excellent.
And that's why I get along with pretty much everyone in Oddcast Planet Live.
No doubt.
I was thinking about that the other day, and I come to the realization that, for the most part, we're just one giant antisocial group.
We're the antisocial social group?
Yeah, pretty much.
Seems legit.
Well, let's face it, a bunch of people probably spend more time talking to our friends in online than people in real life. Most people would probably call that antisocial.
What I like to tell people is, I'm not antisocial, I'm misanthropic. Get it right.
Oh, you went outside of third grade reading level. You lost a bunch of people.
Well, with some of the people I hang out with, yeah, you're right.
I mean, you're from Indiana, so, like, a reading is not the best in the state. I don't know if you know that.
I believe, at least it used to be, Richmond High School was like one of the worst high schools in Indiana as far as graduation rates.
Awesome.
But we do have, you know, such a distinguished alumni as Jim Jones.
Wow. That's awesome. Do you guys have like a plaque or something? That'd be even cooler.
No, we should though. That would be hilarious. Actually, if I get rich, I'm going to do that. I'm going to go, oh yeah, we really need to, you know, have a plaque that has some important people on it. And just right at the top, like Jim Jones or Reverend Jim Jones.
I would so go to that school and take a picture in front of that.
Actually, if you look up the Wikipedia article on him, it actually says where he graduated high school. And if you actually go to the high school Wikipedia page, it'll tell you that him and a dude that played football named, what was his name? Vegas Ferguson. Those are really kind of the only people I know off the top of my head.
Vegas Ferguson is like the coolest name I've heard all day. That's a badass name.
It sounds like someone that should be like a cool like 70s detective.
See, I imagine like this big dude with like chains just wrapped around his fists, like ready to just fuck somebody up.
It's funny you say that because he's actually like one of the nicest people.
Well, that's cool, but I mean, I think it's wasted potential.
He used to let me ditch school all the time because he ended up working at the school.
All right, though, for real, I gotta go to bed. It's been fun hanging out, guys. Catch you guys later.
I'll see you later, 50.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.